The World in Words
is made possible in part
by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Nina Porzucchi here with
Patrick Cox, and this is The World in Words.
Patrick.
Yes.
Do you have a pet at home?
Have had pets.
No, but you have a pet at home right now.
Dead.
Fish died?
Yeah, that's the second fish that died. But they live longer than most fish do. It was the David Bowie fish.
Oh, the
Ziggy.
Ziggy died.
Ziggy died. But Ziggy was about 3 years old.
But I know that you guys talked to Ziggy.
Yes.
Conversations with Ziggy.
We brought Ziggy's colors back. We went away and Ziggy kind of turned very pale. He's called Ziggy because he kind of
he's
has
a beta
got
fish.
His beta fish has got, you know, like fabulous David Bowie like Aladdin saying colors. The colors went away when we went away. And then when we came back, we had to almost coax the colors back.
By talking to Ziggy,
which is what we did. And we played David Bowie songs. It was unclear whether Ziggy was communicating at all, except I have to say that by the colors, by coming back, Ziggy was communicating something, it seemed. Or at least we like to think that.
Oh, well, we have a real expert. We're going to talk this week on the podcast about animal communication. And we have just the person to help us with the question of, are animals talking? What are they saying? Is it language like you and I speaking to one another? So our friend and colleague Ari Daniel from our partner program Nova is in the studio with us.
Hey guys.
Hey Ari.
Hey Ari. And Ari, you used to study this kind of thing.
Yeah, before I became a science journalist, I studied marine mammal communication and behavior.
Why did you go into journalism? That sounds way better.
I like that possibility of getting to learn about lots of different kinds of science, and I'd get seasick.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people get seasick, and oceanographers are people, too.
What do all those howls and growls mean?
Is it language, Ari?
Well, as you might imagine, it's a big question. So I'm going to focus on three totally different species, why and how they communicate, and what that may or may not say about human language. Sound all right?
That sounds good. Can we call you Dr. Doolittle for this?
Sure. No problem. I'll take it. We're going to start in the jungle of Panama during the rainy season.
So most days it rains pretty hard in the afternoon, but clears up by the evening. And it's very, very humid. When you're done showering and you start to dry off, you don't know when to stop because you can't tell when water from the shower ends and when the sweating begins.
Mike Ryan has gone to Panama at least once a year for 30-something years.
In the tropics, the trees get blown down by wind an awful lot. And when it does that, it opens up the forest and then pools of water will form there. And then we'll sit there, and as it starts to get dark, the mosquitoes come out.
And as the last light leaves the sky, that's when it begins. First one,
ew,
then many. These are male Tungara frogs, small inch-and-a-half-long creatures quite dear to Ryan, who's a herpetologist at the University of Texas at Austin.
Their physical appearance comes nowhere matching how majestic their calls sound. So they have these beautiful voices coming out of a little brown, boring body. We can use night vision scopes, or we can even view them under red light, and we can see what happens. The females will come into this chorus of males, swim up to a male, and sit in front of the male for a while. And then they'll move to another one and listen to another male. And they'll do this for a while, sampling the males.
Eventually, a female frog will pick a single male and swim into him.
And then the male clasps her from the top. This is called amplexus. They stay clasped like this for a couple of hours and then they make this foam nest.
So here's the question. How does a female choose a male?
I bet it has something to do with the calls.
And you would be right, Patrick. Let's pull these sounds apart.
So the first part of the call we refer to as a whine, and it sounds like this. Yeah. And if a female hears only a whine, it's necessary and it's also sufficient to attract the female. And when males are calling by themselves, this is what they produce. They produce this whine. But usually, males gather in small choruses.
Inside small pools of water, or even inside wet, muddy footprints made by animals.
And then the males are adding these other syllables to their calls, and they're called chucks. So a whine with a chuck would sound like this. And you'll hear all of these males making up to 7 chucks.
Here's a series of actual Tungara frog calls. The first is just a whine, then a whine with 1 chuck, a whine with 2 chucks, and finally a whine with 3 chucks.
We wanted to know why they do this, why they're adding these syllables to their call.
So Ryan and his team plucked females from the pools and muddy footprints and brought them to the lab. The setup was simple, a sound chamber with 2 speakers.
So one speaker is playing the call, and the other is playing the call, meow.
Know what they found?
So I'm guessing that the whines with the chucks were more attractive to the ladies.
Yes. And how much more attractive do you think, Nina?
I don't know. Twice as much?
More.
3 times?
More.
I don't know, Ari.
Dr. Doolittle.
I don't know, Dr. Doolittle. Sorry.
More than that.
Like 10 times?
No, less than that.
Okay, fine.
Females are 5 times more likely to go to a call with a chuck. So it makes their attractiveness increase by 500%, which is amazing because if we measure the amount of energy that it takes to make a chuck, it doesn't even cost any more energy.
That's crazy. Why would chucks be so much sexier? I mean, I understand. No one likes a person, let alone a frog, that only whines. But still, right? I mean, there's got to be something about the chuck that's a signal to the female that a chucking male is stronger or whatever it is than other males.
Yeah, that's what I thought too, but Ryan hasn't found any evidence for that. Here's what he does know. If you look at our ear, the human ear, we've got a cochlea that allows us to hear sounds in a particular frequency range. In frogs, the ear has 2 parts. One part is tuned to the whine.
The whine? It's the one that's critical to tell the female it's the correct species.
The other part doesn't hear the whine very well, but it does respond to the chuck. So the whine-chuck combo stimulates both sections of the female frog's ear.
This makes her find those males more beautiful.
So if the whine and chuck combo is so much more attractive to females, then why would males ever just make a whine?
Ah, it's not just the females listening to these calls. You know that movie out now with Emily Blunt and John Krasinski, A Quiet Place? It's a fictional horror film, but for the Tungara frogs, that horror is a nightly reality.
As the males are calling, as we're sitting there watching them, all of a sudden, the chorus will go completely silent. And then we'll look up.
And every time, they'll see a fringe-lipped bat flying overhead.
Unlike other bats, instead of using their echolocation to capture the frogs, they home in on the frog's call.
Put a fringe-lipped bat in the same sound chamber as before, fire up the 2 speakers, and the results are identical.
If you give the bats a choice between a whine and a whine chuck, the bats, like the females, they're 5 times more likely to go to a whine chuck than a whine.
Turns out the chuck makes it easier than just a whine for a bat to find a frog.
The chucks aid in their ability to localize the calls.
And then there are the blood-sucking midges that crawl inside a frog's nose for a meal. The midges are also more attracted to a whine chuck than a whine.
It's like not very good evolution.
Any evolution, there's pressure on all sides. And this is a case of kind of sexual selection in some cases because the females are selecting for males that will chuck.
And survive.
But just like with peacocks or something, where the males have these elaborate feathers, and presumably that's been selected for by females over time, a male that has too elaborate of a set of feathers can't move. So there's always this kind of tension between a push from, in the case of sexual selection, there's a push for kind of the trait that is more beautiful or perceived as more attractive. But there's usually a cost, even if that's an energetic, like you got to invest a lot of energy in the feathers or, in this case, getting eaten by a predator.
So what's the cost in humans if you're super attractive? You just like...
I don't know, Nina. Just... I don't suffer from that particular problem.
I don't know. Like... people not take you as seriously?
Ask Fabio.
So these frogs are pretty defenseless. They're almost like, you know, little hamburgers calling out to the predators, eat me, eat me. So this is the conundrum that the frogs are in. They can make themselves more attractive to females, but they do so with a greater risk of predation.
So here's a case where the vocal behavior of an army of frogs.
An army of frogs.
Army
That's
of frogs.
So poetic.
That's actually what it's called, Patrick, an army of frogs. I looked it up. Anyway, here's a case where the vocal behavior of a bunch of frogs is caught between female preference and predatory eavesdropping. And the males have developed a pretty clever solution to balance the two.
They can vary the numbers of chucks in their call.
Trading off safety for sexy, depending on the scenario. On to species number two, at the opposite size extreme.
If you're far away, you'll hear it coming in through headphones, but if you're really close to the animal, the sound is so loud that it will come out of the water. You can hear it in air if you're really close, and sometimes it will actually come through the hull of the boat as well.
Ellen Garland is a marine biologist at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, where she studies humpback whale song. And just like the Tungara frogs, it's only the male humpbacks who sing.
It's either the males who are singing to other males in sort of a male-male competition, or they're trying to sing to females to attract females in. So it's a mating display.
Ari, have you ever gotten to hear a humpback song in the wild?
Unfortunately, no. I've seen humpbacks, but I've never heard them singing in the wild. I used to study killer whales and narwhals, and they produce calls that are way shorter, just like a second or two, compared to humpback song, which can last up to 30 minutes.
Wow. Really, 30 minutes? That's a very long song, Ari.
It is. And so you can think of these songs being made up of themes, which can be broken down into phrases, which themselves can be chopped up into units.
And we name these how they sound. Say, moan, groan, whoop, violin, bellows. So anything like that.
So each humpback whale is kind of like its own symphony?
Well, what's really interesting is that all the males within a population will be singing the same song at the same time. So they match each other. They conform to this one song type at any point in time.
So it sounds like you're saying it's less of a symphony, but more of a chorus that's all kind of got the same sheet music?
Yeah, exactly. But what's really cool is the song is continually evolving. It keeps on changing over time, so units can be added or deleted, or whole themes can be inserted or deleted. And all the males make these changes within their song. And we don't know which males are leading these changes. We just know that it does change, and they all seem to conform to these changes.
Garland did some pretty groundbreaking work a few years back with humpback singing in the South Pacific. She was curious about how these songs were changing.
Yeah, so I listened and analyzed the songs in six different South Pacific populations over an 11-year period.
The analysis took her 3 years.
It wasn't really until the very end that the picture became extremely clear.
Here's what she found. A new song tends to start in Western Australia.
That's the biggest population in the area.
Then that song got adopted by the population in Eastern Australia.
All the males there switched their song. They learnt that song.
And the song continued traveling east.
And then the next year, it was passed on to the next population in the South Pacific.
Meaning whales in New Caledonia and Tonga.
A year later, it was then passed on into the Central South Pacific.
This song, for instance, was all the rage in French Polynesia back in 2004, but it originated in Australia a couple years earlier in 2002.
Wow, that sounds so crazy. It's like the contagion that you get when, you know, a song becomes a hit on the radio and eventually hits the top of the charts.
That's exactly right. And Garland found this wasn't just one or two songs.
This happened multiple times where each of these populations basically threw their song type out the window and learned this brand new variation of the display.
And I mean, that must have been exciting.
It was extremely exciting once we worked out what was happening.
So you almost kind of visualize this as a series of like kind of colored ripples radiating out over the Pacific.
Yeah, but only in a single direction.
Right, it's going west to east.
Correct.
Over a few years, a song travels over 3,500 miles, maybe even farther, due to humpbacks from across the southern hemisphere converging in the waters around Antarctica to feed each year.
There's potential for animals to interact with populations from other ocean basins. I don't know, they could pass a song type around the whole southern hemisphere. That would be amazing.
So it seems like the songs that are arising in Australia are just somehow more popular? Or how do you account for this movement?
It seems like any sort of novel song is really attractive. They really like novel songs. We hypothesize that if you've got a novel song, you might stand out against that background of other singers, and you might be that little bit more attractive to a female if, you know, you're standing out. Maybe you're more likely to get more matings. So being novel is potentially a good thing, but not too novel. They don't tend to just sing whatever they want. They tend to conform to the local song type. It's a little bit crazy, and we're still really trying to nut this out.
Okay, so with the frogs, it was a female preference that pushed the males to like make these whines and chucks that in some ways could get them killed. And now with the humpbacks, it also might be the females that are encouraging like these songs to sort of go viral across the globe, with Australia sort of pumping out one hit after another. You know, they're like the Nashville of the Pacific Ocean.
You got it.
So it feels that females are actually a big influencer in why animals communicate.
Yes, certainly in the cases that I've been describing for you. And I've got one more that goes a step further. So on to species number three, which takes us to West Africa.
So I never stayed in the field less than 4 months, and it's up to a year.
This is Claudia Stefan.
If you're lucky, you have stone-billed huts. Water is always a problem. I mean, usually you have to pump water, so you won't be able to have a cold beer in the evening because you're missing the beer and you're missing the electricity to keep it cold.
Stefan is a cognitive biologist, and when she's not at the University of Neuchâtel in Switzerland, she's living in the middle of the tropical rainforest, in Ivory Coast or on an island off the coast of Sierra Leone, because that's where the Diana monkeys are.
For a primatologist, I would say they're medium-sized, but this only gives a rough idea to non-primatologists.
For any non-primatologists listening, these monkeys are basically 1 to 2 feet tall.
They're very colorful, a whitish face mixed with brown. Their back fur has like a reddish glow. Groups usually consist of one reproductive adult male and several reproductive females, plus their offspring.
And as you probably surmised, these Diana monkeys have another trait that can convince someone like Stefan to spend months on end in a wet jungle without beer.
They are very, very vocal. Both sexes, so females and males of Diana monkeys, also have their very specific predator alarm calls.
For instance, in Ivory Coast, Diana monkeys produce one alarm call if they spot a crowned eagle overhead, and a different alarm call if they see a leopard. These alarm calls alert other members of the group to approach, swarm, and even attack the predator. Eagles and leopards, once they realize they've been spotted, tend to fly off or slink away, since they usually rely on surprise for a successful attack. Dianas aren't the only monkeys that call out in response to a predator, and what fascinates primatologists like Stefan is that the alarm call for an eagle, say, triggers the exact same response in these monkeys as if they'd heard or seen an actual eagle. And the stakes couldn't be higher.
If you use the wrong alarm call, either you are dead or your kin is dead.
Stefan's made a lot of interesting discoveries. On that island off the coast of Sierra Leone, Diana monkeys only have to worry about eagles. There are no leopards. But Stefan wanted to know what would happen if they heard a leopard growl. To find out if these alarm calls are hardwired into the monkeys, or if they learn to associate them with predators over time. So she went into the jungle, lugging a speaker amplifier and CD player. Hiding in the foliage, she played groups of monkeys' eagle shrieks and leopard growls.
When I broadcasted a leopard growl to animals that never faced a leopard during their life, they would just respond to me as if a tree would have fallen down, because they didn't know that it was a leopard. How should they? If you're not really facing mortal danger, you would not know that it's mortal.
Here's the punchline. Diana monkeys depend on real-world experiences to learn how to make their meaningful calls and when to use them. Stefan's next step was to look at how the roles of males and females in Diana monkey society impact their calling behavior. Remember, in a group, you've got one reproductive male and a handful of reproductive females.
The first interest of the male would obviously be to defend females and to keep the group. Because if he loses the group, he will lose his opportunity to sire offspring. He would, of course, do everything to appease and to please his females and to actually convince them that he's the only male who should be able to lead the group.
Which brings us back to dealing with predators. Because if he can show that he's willing to take on an eagle or a leopard, that allows the females to tuck safely into the canopy and huddle with the babies. And here's what that means in terms of alarm calling.
You would need the females to tell the male, hey, come here, I saw a leopard. Could you please deal with that? Then the male would have to reconfirm to the females, hey, I got your point that there's a predator. I will deal with it.
At that point, the females could stay silent. Stefan tested this by playing a predator alarm call, a leopard growl, say, followed by a male leopard alarm call. The females kept quiet, as she expected. But when she followed the leopard growl with a male eagle alarm call, all hell broke loose with the females.
They went crazy. They emitted leopard alarm calls, insisting on their own knowledge, namely that they heard the leopard. And they tried to really be persistent in convincing their male, what does it need until you get it? It's not an eagle, it's a leopard.
Then Stefan did the same thing for the males. She played a leopard growl followed by a female eagle alarm call.
The male is going to respond to an eagle.
Really? I mean, he heard a leopard, but he'll respond to a non-existent eagle just because he heard the female say there was an eagle?
Yeah, because females are very powerful, Patrick.
I don't think that's the only reason this is happening.
The male is calling against his own better knowledge, and he is adjusting to the female's assessment. His first interest is not actually to warn of a predator. No, the first interest of the male is actually to appease his females.
The take-home here is that Stefan's work, along with that of other researchers, has demonstrated that monkey vocal behavior is way more flexible than we once thought.
Not in terms of call production, but in terms of call usage.
Stefan means that Diana monkeys and other primates may have a set of specific call types that can't really be altered, but the way they use those calls, they aren't just responding in a rote, automated way to stimuli. Context matters.
What does this all say about human language, Dr. Doolittle?
It's a really good question, Nina. I asked it of each of the scientists I interviewed. So here's Mike Ryan, the frog guy.
In frogs, I would argue too, in bird song and insect song, they're repeating the same sound over and over again. And what they're really trying to do is to seduce the female with sounds, very much as humans use music to influence the emotive states of other humans.
The humpback whales, says Ellen Garland, take things a step further.
Well, it is one of the most complex acoustic displays in the animal kingdom. How they learn it will actually help us in understanding some of the early human language acquisition.
So it's not language.
No, it is not language. It is a complex display, but I would not call it language. The best analogy we have is sort of human fashion. So a new fad turns up and everyone changes to wear that particular fad, and then something else turns up.
Yeah, and you get a complete changeover in what's stylish.
Exactly.
And when I posed the question to Claudia Stefan, she says that animals, including her Diana monkeys, do share single cognitive capacities with us, things like vocal imitation or recognizing voices. But combining all those capacities and producing language from which we can create infinite meaning.
This is uniquely human. The cognitive toolkit that is actually required to communicate like humans do is much more advanced than we could see in the animal kingdom.
And as I told you at the beginning, this is just a subset of what's out there.
These animals are communicating, but it's not language. They're not talking.
It's not language like we have language, but there are these kind of shadows of things that remind us of what we do when we're speaking. So the Diana monkeys have a call that they produce when they hear an eagle or see an eagle. But does it mean eagle to them? That's a little bit harder to say. But certainly they're not constructing sentences or these long 30-minute songs of humpback whales. We don't think that there's the kind of meaning and that when these elements get recombined, they're saying or meaning something else. The song, it's an attractive display.
Right, so that seems to be a really, really important point and why we glom onto it so much and sometimes maybe romanticize it into sort of language, because they're responding to things that we humans also respond to through language, which is fear and attraction and all of those kinds of things.
Well, and I do think that because we are so language-oriented as a species, that's how we function, that we can't help but project those kind of linguistic imaginings onto other species in our life. And I'm not saying that dogs or fish aren't communicating or even communicating across species lines. I mean, we have ways of communicating with other species, but it's not language. And here I am leaving you with yet another unsatisfying conclusion.
Ari Daniel, science, ?
Yeah, I talk for 20 minutes and then I tell you we don't actually know.
Thanks so much, Ari, for coming in this week and sharing a little bit about animal communication.
Ha! If I could talk to the animals, I'd just imagine it chatting with a chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting with a cheetah. Oh, what a neat achievement it would be.
And that's all for this week. If you are interested in learning more about animal communication, you should check out Nova Wonders, What Are Animals Saying? And you can find that at pbs.org/Nova Wonders. Thanks so much to Ari Daniel, Mike Wilkins, Tina Toby.
Thanks also to Jody Gersh and Lauren Rothering.
Thanks, Ziggy, wherever you are. Most importantly, thanks to you for listening.
Abba.
If I conferred with our furry friends, man to animal, think of the amazing repartee. If I could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt, squeak, just walk with the animals, and Lord, they could talk to me.
The World in Words
is made possible in part
by the National Endowment for the Humanities.